Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
Our own idea of success is so wrapped up in what others are doing and what we perceive to be the expectation of success. And if you can do some soul searching for yourself and figure out what's important to you and your practice and where you want it to go, where you see it, where you see your work living, then you'll be a lot more satisfied. I'm still working on that myself.
Oh, friends, I am so excited to welcome Anna Ogier-Bloomer, who is a feminist artist who uses photography to explore domestic spaces, dynamics, and cultural signifiers within her Midwestern family. Anna's work has been published on The Huffington Post, Refinery 29, and The Daily Mail, among others. She has been a resident at the Wassaic Project in New York, the Project for Empty Space in Newark, New Jersey, and most recently at Stay Home Gallery in Paris, Tennessee. Woot woot. She holds an MFA from Parsons and an MPS in digital photography. Anna is an expert in professional practices, holding positions in career services at Parsons, SVA, and soon Otis College of Art and Design in Los Angeles. She has advised thousands of artists from around the world and lectures widely on artists' professional practices. Anna actually came to the in-person retreat we had in Tennessee in 2019 and gave such an inspiring presentation. I know, like, all of us just wanted her to talk for the whole day, and it was just so wonderful to hear what she has to offer. And I'm just delighted to welcome you to the podcast, Anna, my friend and an amazing, inspiring artist mama. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Kaylin, thank you so much. I'm honored to be part of this. I'm a huge fan of the podcast and everything that you do.
Okay, so let's get started. I want you to point us back to something in your childhood that got you interested in art and maybe share just a few high points along your journey.
So the start for me where it became real is very clear for me.
Ooh, I love that. It's so not clear for me, but I love that it's clear for you.
Well, so photography was always a part of our family's life. My dad loved to take pictures, and we had always had slideshows. And for the youngins out there, you would shoot film, and it came back to you from the lab on a little card that you put in a big tray and a loud projector, put it on a big screen that we unrolled in our house. And it was a big family event to look at slides.
Oh, I love that.
It's the best.
So your dad was a photographer?
Yes. Cool. Yeah. I mean, just for
family.
Fun. Family and travel and nature and just whatever. but he always loved it. And my brother took pictures too. So it was just, we all took photos. That was a fun thing to do. And we always did art. I just did art all the time as a kid, but I wasn't great at it. Mm-hmm. Drawing and painting, things like that. But in high school, I won the photography contest that my class did. I think it was a senior or a junior. It was a junior. And realized, oh, like this might be a thing. Mm. It's not just something I enjoy. Mm-hmm. But maybe I'm making pictures that other people are moved by or affected by or just think are good. Just that one time, this one picture. So then I started looking at art schools to go to for college, and got into a couple and went to the museum school, which is now SMFA at Tufts University officially. And that was, I would say, the experience that just shaped me as an artist and really started me on my whole career.
Hmm. Did you feel like ready to go to art school? Or, like, had you done photography in high school, or were you kind of just really dipping your toe in and then you got into a good school and that is kind of what launched you forward?
I did a lot of art in high school. I was in AP art, but again, I would say I was mediocre at a lot of it.
Yeah.
And I'm very lucky to have had AP Art as an offering in my high school.
I didn't even know AP Art was a thing, actually.
Yeah. And my art teacher was so devoted, and we, you know, all of us who were in it were really, it was like mini art school. I mean, we were just
deep
in it all the time.
And was this in Cincinnati?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Cincinnati. Yeah, okay. A public school. And I took a couple photo classes at the Art Academy of Cincinnati, which is a small independent art school there. And that was really fun. And I got to make photos with all these grown-ups, which was really cool. I loved working in the darkroom alongside like 40-year-old women.
That's awesome.
Which is me now, but yeah. At 17, I was like, oh my gosh, you're so grown up. And I think I got into the art schools because I had very good grades. Academically, I was very strong. And they maybe saw some potential in the art, but I was definitely not one of these art star people, prodigies. And I still can't draw or paint worth a darn. So,
But they noticed you were a hard worker and, you know, like obviously you had some talent and, you know, like you said, good grades. And so it was there, you know?
Yeah, there was a lot there. Yeah. And museum school was a great choice because you could take any art class you wanted in any area. I spent a year and a half doing textile dyeing using the methods of the Yoruba tribe of Western Nigeria.
That's cool.
And always, it was so cool. And always doing photo. But the one thing I never did was performance because I have a lot of performance anxiety. But you could do anything. And at the end of the 4 years, I was like, I'm a photographer. That's what I do. But things like drawing, even though I was never good at it, I always took a drawing class. It always helped me to see.
That's great.
It's just a really important part of learning composition as a photographer, I think.
And you went kind of a more traditional route. Did you go to grad school right after undergrad?
I took it felt like a lot of time. Gosh, I guess it was only 4 years, but it was a really long and important 4 years between the two.
What did you do during those 4 years?
I moved to New York City and tried to make my way, which involved, you know, working 5 or 6 jobs at a time and try to scrape it all together and find a safe place to live, which involved moving 5 times in my first year in New York and trying to find my people, find an art community. And the first 2 years are really hard, but because New York will try to beat you down and get you to leave. But I found a really amazing group of artist friends there. And it actually happened through a class that I took for free at the university I was working at, the New School. And it was a writing class for artists to help us craft statements and proposals.
Ooh, that sounds great.
It was fantastic. I didn't get that much better at my writing, and that's my fault. The teacher was incredible. But I met some people who became some of the most important art friends and personal friends that I'll ever have.
Okay, Anna, can you share just a bit about like what your work looks like for somebody who maybe has not come across any of your images? And I bet they actually probably have, but maybe they don't know that it was your work. So tell me a little bit about what your work looks like and maybe just a little bit about your process.
Sure. So most of my images are square color photographs. They're all color. I don't shoot black and white. Very documentary style. So I capture candid moments of my family members and sometimes myself. And my children, my parents, my sister, and it's usually in sort of mundane domestic activities. There are some major life events that I'll try to capture, but there's almost always a figure. I rarely shoot a landscape or an image of a space that's devoid of a human figure. Not very good at that. I feel like I'm much better at photographing people. And I really admire those who can make powerful images without a person in them because I love those pictures. So I have a few of those, but usually you'll see a person who is either captured not looking at the camera, engaging in whatever they happen to be doing, because I try to just roam around the house or the yard or wherever we are with the camera and hope that they'll eventually just ignore me. And sometimes they'll directly engage with me and look directly into the lens. And I like those images too. I like to kind of have both, because when they do engage with me, there's a power mm-hmm. that they have, and I really enjoy that. I think my subjects are vulnerable, and they look vulnerable in my pictures because they're not dolled up or dressed up for photos. They might not have makeup on. They might not have their nice shirt. They could have been crying. They could be exhausted. It could be dirty. You know, all the ways that we want to present ourselves, you know, as our physical best in a picture. Mm-hmm. That's what they're not in these images. So they often look vulnerable, but when they engage directly with my lens, I can see in them that they gain a little bit of power over me and over the picture. And I really enjoy that because I want the pictures to be, their choice. You know, I'm not trying to have a gotcha moment mm-hmm. for my subjects. They really have to be okay with the picture that I'm making.
And is that why you primarily, if not always, photograph your family and people you know?
Oh, yeah.
Because your work is based on relationship, I feel like, is what you're saying, you know?
Yeah.
And without, you know, unless you were like some undercover street photographer type person, like, you know, you wouldn't have those moments with people unless they were in relationship with you. So, you know, your subjects are the people that are closest to you and that are in relationship with you, right?
Yes, you're absolutely right. And there are photographers whom I greatly admire and are the people who've inspired the work that I make, who are incredible at doing just that, making a picture that demonstrates a relationship between the photographer and a total stranger. Mm-hmm. And some people just have that ability, or they worked at it. They decided that's what they wanted to do. And so they became very good at that and learned how to create a relationship with their subject, even though they might be strangers, mm-hmm. On a moment's notice, or get to know them first. And I love that kind of work. And it's not for me, and I have enough hurdles to overcome in trying to make my art and make pictures that I figured out what I love to do. And it's not that I don't push myself, but I have done work where I photographed other people, and I have found that it doesn't have the same kind of meaning for me.
Mm-hmm. I think that, like, just as you're speaking, I have a dear, dear friend. He actually photographed the birth of my first kid. And he's a documentary photographer who lives in Philly. I'll have to introduce you guys sometime. But his name's Andrew Huth, and he has done like a lot of international documentary photography, works a lot with kids and like different things. But he has that ability. I don't know like what it is about Andrew, but he can just get those vulnerable looks from people he has spent 10 minutes with, you know, mm-hmm. like he can just, I don't know, like, and it's a gift, but also I mm-hmm. know it's a skill that it's almost like he's worked at that skill more than he's maybe worked at being a photographer. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense, but I feel like he like works at, I don't know, like getting in with people as much as he, you know, works at taking good pictures.
Absolutely.
It's interesting.
That's way harder.
Yeah. Well, I think what you do is really hard too, though. And I wanted to talk to you about this. I hope we're not diving into this too early, just because your work is so vulnerable in that you know, like, even though Andrew takes a lot of vulnerable pictures, the most of what he shares are not pictures of his own life, you know? Mm-hmm. And I just admire the way that you're willing to photograph yourself, photograph your family, photograph the messiness and the chaos and the the tenderness and, you know, the moments that feel maybe scarce or hard. And like, that's your work. And but that also is like your life. Like that's really hard.
Yeah. And thank you. There have been a lot of times that I could not get a camera out.
Yeah.
When my grandmother died, my mother's mother, I couldn't pick that thing up. Mm. Just trying to deal, you know? Mm-hmm. There, you know, there are other moments, other deaths in our family that felt different, mm-hmm. and taking pictures of that experience was actually really important. It was important for me. It was important for others. When my dad's dad died, my senior year of college, I was learning large format photography. And for those not familiar, it's the giant view camera, like an Ansel Adams. Mm-hmm. And it takes a lot of work to set up just one picture and a lot of time and big cumbersome equipment. And I brought it with me to Toledo, Ohio, where my grandparents live and my dad grew up. And my dad really wanted me to take pictures of the experience of my grandfather dying. And so I have some long exposure photographs that I made with this camera in the hospital room where, well, my grandfather, the night that he passed away. And it didn't feel like a violation of a moment. It felt like the right thing to do. And part of that was because my dad asked me, and it meant something to him to do that. So I really have to, I read the moment, and I also have worked really hard to give myself permission to not photograph at certain things. Mm. Like, my work isn't about capturing every single important event in the Osier Bloomer life. And that, at first, that was kind of hard to grapple with. I missed this thing. Like, I'll never have a chance to photograph that thing again. I'm over it now.
Yeah.
you're a parent. Oh my God. There's so many events, so many important moments. And as I get older, people die. So many people, everybody dies. Mm-hmm. Right. And, sometimes you just have to be there.
Yeah. I wonder too, like just hearing you talk, you know, I think sometimes people think of photography as this invasive thing, and like maybe people who take photographs of, you know, those really hard moments, like, I mean, to me, I don't even want to say this word because to me this word is too strong, but it can feel like a violation.
Absolutely.
But, you know, just hearing you talk, I'm like, you know, in the same way that somebody would bake a casserole or like show up and offer to watch the kids or fill up your tank of car with gas. Like, you know, the ways that we care for each other are out of the gifts that we have, you know? And so I just feel like, yes, like you might be doing something that is difficult, but also like you're using your gifts to honor your family, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes they don't feel
Do you
that
get
way.
Pushback from them?
Sometimes. Yeah. I mean, mostly no, and I've kind of stopped trying to photograph family members who I'm not comfortable with, or they're maybe not comfortable with it. Mm-hmm. And I just that's fine. Mm-hmm. Because again, my job is not to be omnipresent and shoot everybody and everything, but just kind of my experience with my family. Mm. But I've had some family members I had one in particular who was very supportive of the work, and I have releases. Everyone's had to sign a photo release before I publish any of the pictures online or anywhere. And everybody signed it. I've never had anybody who didn't sign it. But I did have one person who then said I could no longer show him. Mm. And then he changed his mind a little bit later, and you know, I hardly ever see this person anymore, so it's kind of a non-issue. But there's some ups and downs for sure. And with everything being so visible online now, I mean, this was not an issue, not a problem, you know, 7 years ago.
Right. Yeah.
I'm older than you, and
yeah.
When I started, I mean, so far, still the majority of my career as an artist, and even as a, you know, a young artist learning that career, being a student, was spent in mostly obscurity. And you can have all the shows you want, but mm-hmm. still, like, hardly anybody in the world is going to see them. And now, with Instagram, and things like when my pictures were in the Daily Mail, like, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people are seeing these things in seconds. So
yeah, that's crazy.
It's a lot more to, like, modulate with my family.
You know? It adds a whole new level, you know, and then their bodies, their experiences are published in platforms that maybe they don't even know about, you know?
Right.
That's just crazy.
And they are. And I have discovered my work, you know, on websites that were weird or surprising. But then even, you know, I have all those pictures that I know you're aware of, but photographing my daughter, the experience of having my first child and breastfeeding, which was the most beautiful and incredible experience of my life. And I'm so grateful for it. It's also very, very hard and physically demanding, and can be painful, but also very pleasurable in many ways at the same time. And these pictures were very popular. They kind of rocketed around the internet. And then I discovered that in Googling myself that they had ended up on some white supremacist site where they're talking about my daughter and,
oh my gosh,
my husband, who is African American. And, that was like the moment. That was tough.
Yeah. Oh, I can't imagine.
And it's happening all the time. We probably don't even know about it, because I can't dig into myself on Google that deeply anymore.
At some point you just kind of have to bury your head and keep going, right?
Yeah. We did decide to stop posting images of the kids on our social media after that, which I realized, like, my kids are in my work, so it's hard for me, and I'll kind of, like, really juggle. There are a lot of pieces I've made, a lot of work, art, that I haven't put online because it's of my kids, and maybe they're nude or we're nude, and I'm not sure what to do about potential negative response, you know. I want to protect their privacy, so it's tough.
It is tough because it's, like, really unfortunate. I know some of the photographers that I love and who have influenced me the most are people who take photos like you of, like, your kid half naked in the yard, like, you know, in the sprinkler and the evening sun and, you know, like, those, that's, like, real life, you know, and it's just unfortunate that the internet has sort of created this atmosphere where, I don't know, we have to be on guard, I guess.
Yeah.
Anna, I want to hear you talk just a little bit about what your life is practically like, because I know, you know, I think we have this idea, like, we go to art school and we're just going to make it as an artist. And I know you talk to thousands of artists about this. Have you ever worked solely just as an artist, or have you always had other jobs, and maybe what are some of the other jobs that you've had? Cause I already know the answer to that. and just maybe talk a little bit about that, like, work and art life balance that you have experienced.
Yeah. It's a constantly shifting thing, how to make it work and, what my life looks like practically. But yes, I have always, had a full-time job, or several jobs. And no, I've never just worked on my art, and supported myself that way. And I think there are a number of reasons for that. Number one is that I'm a person who craves routine and stability, and I could never do freelance. The anxiety of always looking for a job is was too much for me. And I get very lucky to not have had to have a job during college. I did an internship, you know, but I didn't have to work. My parents supported me, which is amazing. But when I graduated, I began working, and my temp in the career office at Harvard University. That was the first job I had out of college.
Nice.
Which was sounds really nice, but it was just because I lived down the street from Harvard.
Okay.
And I feel very, it was very fortuitous that I got that job because it set me on the path for my other career, because I see that I have two careers now, being a career counselor and advisor. And so I did that temporarily. Then I moved to New York, and that helped me get a job at the new school in the career office. But it was before I got that, I was temping there making IDs. and get this, Caitlin, I was making them with Polaroids
and
a typewriter.
Oh my gosh.
On sticky labels that I then put into a machine and laminated on the spot. You'd walk in, I would take your Polaroid. It was
so literally was, anybody could have janked one of those. And
I made 5 or 6 for myself. I still have them. I mean, the other person I was working with, they're having a blast, just making tons of IDs.
That's so funny. We'll have to get a picture of one of those in the interview post.
I'll dig them up. And this was 2006, so the school's pretty behind. We shouldn't have been using a typewriter in 2006, but anyway. And I had a medical issue that happened in 2007, and so I ended up hospitalized, and I had to then pay off medical bills for a number of years, and so there was no not working full time for me. And it was tough. I knew a lot of folks who were living in such a way that they could just do some work here and there and make art and, you know, and get by for a while and then go do a thing. And it just wasn't for me. Mm-hmm. I'm not that cool. I'm not that bohemian. I wish I was. I'm much more, I guess, traditional in that way. Yeah. But
I think there's a lot fewer artists who are bohemian than we think there are. Most of us want a place to sleep and food to eat and, you know.
The other thing is that, like, my art, while people are moved by it and really love it, don't want to look at it all the time. Mm. So I don't sell very much. I hardly sell anything. I get published in a lot of, like, journals, like, beautiful publications. I love that. And I get residencies and grants, but very few people want to have my work over their sofa, which I respect because I don't even want to look at my pictures in my house for very long. So
I would want one of your photos. Oh. We'll have to make that happen.
Okay, we'll figure that out.
Yeah, that's interesting, though, because I think, like, did you have to have this switch where you kind of let go of some of that, like, my art is valuable when it can be monetized or when I can sell or when I can make a living? Like, did you have, like, is that something you're still processing, or did you have, like, this moment where you kind of just, I don't know, like, dropped that in the water and let it go, you know? And it was like, my art can just be what it can be, and I don't have to tie it to monetary value.
Mm-hmm. So no, I was always in the zone of I'm making art because of art, man. Mm. Like, this is about the work.
Yeah.
And I had studied under documentary photographers and looked at so many of those kinds of pictures and the work that those people have done in history to tell stories, and they don't make any money from that. And so it was just never part of the narrative for me. Also, museum school is so anti-capitalist. Mm-hmm. So, and everybody I knew then worked, and I wonder if it was just the moment, because I definitely see now, having worked with art students for so many years now, they come in these waves, and you'll have a whole class come in and leave with this set of expectations that are shared. And then the class next year or 2 years later has a very different view on art making or living as an artist. Mm-hmm. And so just at the time, every artist I knew was just like, get a job, pay the bills, pay the rent, survive, and try to make art at the same time. You know?
Yeah, well, that's the nice thing is, like, you, in a way, you never you never did tie it to the art because you just naturally thought you had to have another job anyway. And so then your work could always be about the work. I just think it's such an interesting moment, like you said, because, you know, artists now are in this beautiful space where, like, freelancing is more normalized, you know, and it is more routine. And I think, like, people can kind of create this hodgepodge of, you know, of an art career and really be successful. Like, there's so many more entrepreneurs, you know, who are artists or who are artists who are learning about entrepreneurial tactics and things. But then, you know, it also does change, I don't know, like, there's a cheapening to it almost, where it's just like every single thing is about, you know, the monetization of the work. It feels like, I don't know. It's like, how can we have this balance where we can make a living, but also we still have this, I don't know, that recklessness of just making the work for making the work. And it's not just tied to what we'll sell. I just feel like that's like something artists now think about all the time. At least I know I do.
All the time. I love that you described it as recklessness. I think that's such a beautiful way to think about it. It is. You have to be reckless. Mm-hmm. If you're not, then you're not going to make what you need to make. And you're absolutely right that, I mean, today, you know, all the students I work with are so, so concerned, and rightly so, about how to survive and make a living, and that they won't get to make their art if they have to work a job, some other job all the time. Mm-hmm. And my husband, I talked him into going to grad school, so I am personally responsible for his entire art career. he will give me that credit, and I will take it. And when he did that, he quit his full-time job, and for a year, he worked a little bit, but mostly he didn't. And his art career just took off, and it's taken off for many, many reasons. But I did see in that time, and I do believe, that an artist's potential cannot be fully realized if they are spending 40 or 50 or 60 hours a week doing something else.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody would disagree with me, because just like the math of that, you know, it's impossible. And so I don't believe that I've reached my full potential in terms of an art career, because of the way my life is. Mm-hmm. And okay, this is my art practice. It is what it is.
Mm-hmm. And to add to that multi-layered life of responsibilities and, you know, challenges, you're a mom of two little babies. Well, they're not babies anymore, but two kiddos. <They're kids. laughs> I call all kids like under the age of 10 babies. Like, they're your babies, you know?
Yes. I think we'll always feel like they are.
Yes. Last call for retreat tickets. If you haven't heard, we are hosting a virtual retreat this year on October 9th and 10th. I am thrilled to share an amazing lineup with you of presenters. Joey Farso and Latoya Hobbs will be sharing artist talks. Isadora Stowe is leading a workshop on creativity and failure. Liesl Strauss is speaking on empowerment and self-care. And the wonderful women of Carve Out Time for Art, Marissa Huber and Heather Kirkland, are sharing their journey producing a book on art and motherhood. Mindy Wittick is also leading a nostalgic soft sculpture workshop, and the powerhouse duo behind the Feminist Incubator Program and Project for Empty Space, Rebecca Jampool and Jasmine Wahi, are sharing a presentation called Art Wives, A Mama and Godmama Talk About Support Structures, Creating Visibility, and Strategies for Challenging Patriarchal Oppression. Woo! I am blown away that all of this has come together and we are able to share this with you. But that's not all, of course. We will be having a few surprise presenters, loads of giveaways, and lots of opportunities for you to meet and connect with artist mamas from across the world. I can't wait for this amazing weekend, and I hope you will consider joining us for some rest, rejuvenation, and major, major, major inspiration. Check out all the details and book your spot at artistmotherpodcast.com and hit the retreat button on our homepage. Doors close October 1st, so you just have a few more days to snag your ticket. Don't miss your chance at joining us on this great weekend. So I want to hear you talk, you know, just about your motherhood journey and how that has shaped your art career. Like, when you were pregnant with your daughter, Violet, your oldest, did you plan on making work about motherhood? Did you always know it was something that you wanted to explore? Or did you kind of, I don't know, have to arrive at that?
Oh, yeah, totally arrived. I mean, I was dragged there, I guess. I was dragged to that point. I've never wanted to take pictures of myself. So doing that with Violet, she was a baby, that was new and scary territory for me and very vulnerable. And I still don't like taking pictures of myself. So it's very rare that I'll find one that I feel like works. But I almost didn't have that first kid. I was very afraid of losing my identity as a person, as a woman, by becoming a mother. And my husband and I were planning to have family. We wanted to. It happened much faster than we expected. Because it's a mysterious thing, this whole baby-making thing. And then I wasn't sure if I was ready yet. And I didn't know if I wanted to go through with it. And I actually talked to my mom about that loss of identity, and the conversation was really helpful. She's someone who is such an inspiration to me, always has been, and has been an incredible subject in my work and extremely tolerant. She does not like pictures of herself.
She's a rock star.
She's a rock star. She's incredible. She's a maternal child health nurse, a baby nurse. She's a lactation consultant. She used to have her own business when we were little. I don't even know how she did this. She had a lactation consulting practice when my my brother and I were babies, and we're 2 years apart. So she had us, and then later she became a public health nurse for the city of Cincinnati, where she would go into the very lowest income homes, most poverty-stricken people in and families in Cincinnati, and would do physical exams on new moms and babies. And she is tough as nails, this woman.
She sounds amazing.
I could not have put up with the pain and the suffering that she saw and in supporting these women and these babies. I could not have handled it. Now I lost my train of thought. Where was I going with that?
I'm curious to know what she said to you. You said you like had this moment of asking her about losing your identity, and you know, she helped you through that. And if you remember like some specifics, like I'm just, you know, what did she say? Like, what was her experience?
I think she really just said that she was worried too, that she had the same worry. She had these jobs and was a nurse and everything, but she also was just the stay-at-home mom. And she did those things, but mostly just dedicated her life to raising three kids and gave herself over to it. She wanted it. She wanted to raise kids in the way that she wasn't raised, and she wanted to make a family that was very counter to the kind of family she grew up in, one that was just really warm and loving and safe. So she set out to do that. But I think it was comforting to hear from her that I've always thought she had this clarity that that's what she wanted her life to be. But to hear from her that she also was worried about that too, when she was young and set off on this path, that was helpful. But that's as detailed as I remember.
Yeah. I mean, just knowing that your mom felt the same way about you as something is helpful, I think. Comforting.
Yeah.
She sounds like a remarkable person.
She is. Yeah. She's a lot of fun too. She's
Anna, if you're willing to share, I would love to hear just a little bit about your experience with childbirth, and if you feel like that influenced just anything about your perception of yourself, or even yourself as an artist, like, you know, this act of creation, like putting work into the world, I feel like is so monumental, and then to also have this experience of this mundane, you know, historical, very normalized experience of having a child and yet mm-hmm. obviously the most profound and incredible thing we can do. Mm-hmm. Have you found those two things to be connected? Like, did you learn about yourself when you gave birth?
Well, it totally changed me both times. And the first one was really hard. It was pretty terrible. And, I'm someone who's typically has a very low threshold for pain. So my family was like, oh, Anna's going to freak out about giving birth. And I was cool as a cucumber the whole pregnancy. I watched the movies. I did the breathing classes. I was like, I'm cool. This is good. I got this.
Yeah.
And, the hospital, the doctors, they were just the worst. And I had tons of tearing. They didn't sew me back up properly.
No. And the itching that comes with the not sewing up properly.
Oh my God. Well, I had to have surgery a year later.
Anna, I'm sorry.
It was, and I'm going to share all the details because your listeners can handle all this.
Yes, they can. Too.
It was totally not what I expected. And I was like, I can, you know, sometimes you feel like you can make the birth that you want happen. Mm-hmm. And I thought that's what we were going to do. And you have to fight against doctors. I was prepared for that. And this was just so not that. I eventually saw a new OBGYN a year later because I was just in pain all the time. And he was a high risk OBGYN specialist. And when he examined me for the first time, he responded with, and he's Haitian, and he responded with, this shouldn't have happened to you because this is America.
What's
happened down there.
Oh my gosh. And you're like, that's reassuring.
I was butchered, essentially.
This is America.
This is not a third world country, he said. This is not how it should have happened to you. So I couldn't even sit on the subway comfortably.
Oh my gosh.
It was bad. So needless to say, I had a lot of trauma. I still have trauma from that experience.
Yeah.
And I even find that, like, when I see my friend's newborn pictures in the hospital, I get some anxiety about it. Not for myself, but for others. I don't know. I mean, the post-traumatic stress is real, mm-hmm. A little bit. So the work that I made about Violet and breastfeeding could not have happened, obviously, if I hadn't had the experience that I had. And, mm-hmm. you know, we had a very hard time latching. So breastfeeding was really difficult at first, but it was really important to me and I wanted to make it work. And thank goodness my mom, this amazing expert, was there to physically help. We needed that. But, you know, I went back to work and you're pumping all the time and the milk is just everywhere. And again, I was
How old was she when you went back to work?
3 months.
So hard.
It was so hard. 3 months is basically still newborn.
Right. Like
they just came out of you.
It's, yeah. Oh my gosh.
In no way ready for that.
And you guys were living in New York at this time. So it's like cost of living is crazy, right?
Yes. Yes. That was a tough time. And my husband was still working full time. So she was in daycare, you know, 50 hours a week. And I was just constantly tortured by the feeling that I was not doing right by her. And would essentially just see her going to bed, which maybe luckily took 4 hours to get her to go to sleep at night. So, that was my time with her. But then weekends, it's like I see my kid on weekends.
So tough. But now you've made some changes. And why don't you walk us through like a little more of what your life has been like more recently and in the light of COVID, the crazy 2020 global pandemic that we've all been dealing with for how many months? 6 months?
God.
7 months?
Maybe this issue will, this interview will get released like 6 or 4 months from now, and we'll all be like, what was that about COVID? Oh, that must have been hard. Glad it's over now.
Or if people listen to it, you know, a few years from now, I'm like, I hope this is like irrelevant, but
yes,
I don't know. I don't know. I think we're going to remember this.
The last 2 years have been a lot of ups and downs. And, you know, I've been the primary breadwinner for the last four years or so. And as my husband was getting his art career going, and again, that, you know, that piecemeal mm-hmm. kind of living that comes from being an artist is something, you know, my stable work was able to help support. And I'm happy, happy to do that. And then we moved from New York to Chicago. And so I was home with the kids while I was looking for work. And, you know, I would have enjoyed that, I think, if I hadn't had to have the frantic feeling of trying to find a job, because mm-hmm. we really needed that. But for the last week, I've been enjoying being home with my kids. And a lot has happened in between there. And COVID, I don't know, it's just, it's created a lot of logistical and changes and issues for us, of course, and emotional distress. But what I think it's done for me, and probably for a lot of people, is like, created a release to the uncertainty of the future. And just kind of, when it happened in March, it kind of broke down for me all of the things I felt like I was sure about, how things had to look and what was important to me in my life. And I really wanted the kids to be in a place where they could, you know, go outside and run around and have a community that was, that we had all the kind of amenities. I mean, there's tons of parks where we live in this neighborhood called Oak Park, right outside Chicago. It's very much still urban. We're still on the subway lines. Well, the L, whatever, it's still mm-hmm. the subway to me. But lots of outdoor green space for the kids and pools and all these wonderful things I really wanted for them. And that's all going to change again. I had to let go of this life here because I got laid off from my job here in Chicago.
Due to COVID, right?
Due to COVID, exactly, yeah. Yes. I was working at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago in the dean's office doing academic planning work, which is outside of my career services wheelhouse, but was relevant. And I was part of a mass layoff there this past summer, and it was scary for a little while, but I landed a new job, which is a dream job, to lead my own career services department at a top art school. So, yeah. So now we're moving to Los Angeles, and life is going to look so, so different yet again. And I've been worried about what that's going to do to the kids. But I'm blessed with an amazing 7-year-old, soon to be seven, in a week and a half, who, when we turned to her a few months ago, when we knew things were changing. I hadn't lost my job yet, but we just didn't know what school was going to look like in the fall, but we knew it wasn't going to be the same. We said, how would you feel if you had to go to a new school this fall? And she turned to us slowly, because she's dramatic, and made her eyes wide and went, amazing.
Oh, sweet girl.
We were like, she doesn't understand. Let's explain what's going to happen. You wouldn't see your same friends every day. You'd have to, you know, get together on the weekends. And she's like, yeah, but it's always important to make new friends.
No. Oh.
So she's the opposite of the way I was as a kid, which is great.
Yeah. Well, you know, we just moved, and our oldest is 8, and he did amazing. Like, and he's the most sentimental, like, he has a tender little heart, but I mean, I think it is a good age. Like, he was excited, and, you know, he's had his moments, like, where he cried, you know, a couple times about missing my parents and, you know, different things like that. But it wasn't like this big dramatic, he's sad and, like, he is adjusting. It was kind of like, he's feeding off it. He's liking it. He's liking the energy. He's liking the newness. So it might be an age thing too.
That's great. That's so reassuring.
I hope that's the same, you know, for your kids.
Yeah. I mean, my husband's family is all in LA. That's where he grew up. And so it'll be wonderful to be around them. And Violet has always wanted to learn to surf. And so I promised her we would do that.
That's awesome. Oh, I can't wait to hear you. Well, yes, that. But also just hear about I don't know, your life in LA. So now you've had these like three major, you know, cities, like big moments in your life where you've gone through transition. How have you, you know, held on to your art practice throughout these things?
It definitely has an ebb and a flow, and I've had to work very hard on telling myself that that's fine. Hmm. That, I mean, a few years ago, I had a period where a year I didn't apply to anything. For a couple of years, I just did what things that came to me, and there wasn't a lot of high profile stuff, but the few things were very meaningful, and that was great. I have to focus on, sometimes I have to focus on my job for a while. Sometimes I have to focus on the family for a while. And I can't figure out a formula to it. Mm-hmm. And I love the artists who are like, oh, I work in the summer because I'm a professor and whatever. And then I do these other things during the year. Or, you know, for me, it's a little bit madness. Mm-hmm. It's like, I can do this now. I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
I went to stay home residency now a week and a half or 2 weeks ago. It was incredible. And it was like, you know, 8 hours a day of scanning, which is really not fun.
Yeah.
But it's so hard for me to get that done at home because the kids, I mean, I was working on some photos the other night and the kids come over and they tap some keys and boom, you've done actions in Photoshop by just hitting keys.
No.
it's real hard to work with them around. So
yeah.
I have these pockets of time, I'll take advantage, and then you know, things slow down in one area and I just have to I just go with flow. But it wasn't easy to get to the point where I was okay with that. There's always these shoulds of should be working on this, I should be making this. I used to get asked from some friends or family members, I think it was before I had kids. Now I never get asked this, but when's your next show? Oh, that's, no artist wants to hear that because if you don't have the next show planned, then you feel terrible, right?
Yeah, yeah.
If any non-artists listening, don't ask.
Oh, I had someone recently, like she knew that I didn't have a show in the, like, I don't know if she, this was her follow-up question to, like, maybe she asked me when my next show, and I was like, oh, I don't have one. She's like, oh, are you not doing art anymore? And I was like, seriously?
Oh my God.
I know. I was like, oh my gosh. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It's just that easy to just.
Oh, just to have, just you to have whatever off. Show you want.
Yeah.
I'm going to have a show today.
Yeah.
And you know what? Another cool thing to come out of COVID, maybe cool is a strong word, but like the emphasis on the physical show has been lifted.
Yeah.
Obviously, we can hardly have any of them. And if you're having them, no one's going to go see it, really.
Right.
So, although I'm in a physical show at Stay Home Gallery and I'm so excited to be part of it.
Yeah.
First of all, you and Pam are doing an amazing job promoting the work online.
Thanks, Anna.
You really get to, because I was looking at all these pictures and experiencing it before I got to go there physically, and I just had a great sense of it.
Oh, good. That's good to hear.
Oh yeah, it totally worked and is still working to promote this work. But there's so many other cool things that people are starting up. Because of our limitations now. And it's really exciting for artists. It's breaking down all these barriers or starting to break down barriers that have made the art world such an exclusive place to mm-hmm. begin with. And, you know, other work that you guys are doing and what a lot of folks are doing to bring people together, no matter where they are, bring opportunities to people. It's really exciting.
Yeah, I agree. I think there are some positive things that have come out of COVID that it's hard not to appreciate, you know, like even though it's been so traumatizing and how many hundreds of thousands of people have lost their lives and, you know, it is horrible, but also it's kind of like the wheel has broken a little bit, you know, and we can reimagine and move forward in new ways. I think that's the best we can hope for right now.
Yeah. And certainly we would all prefer for this to have never happened and we would all be, but I don't think it's never going to be the same again. Even once this particular virus is under control, the way that we all interact with each other is never going to be the same. And, you know, artists are good at thinking creatively. And you mentioned entrepreneurs earlier. We're very entrepreneurial, and people are coming up with other ways to reach audiences and reach each other. And I think that's going to stick around.
Mm-hmm. Me too. Okay. And I want to ask you about kind of one more topic before we wrap up. In your bio, you call yourself a feminist artist. And I'm curious to hear you just talk a little bit about that term. And if you have, you know, just any specific ways that you feel like being a woman has influenced your art career, or stories that you want to share.
Yeah, I started calling myself that in my bio and publicly after being the feminist in residence at Project for Empty Space in Newark, which is co-founded and co-run by Rebecca Jampol and Jasmine Wahi, two incredible women and feminists. And that residency was, I mean, that was the job title of my dreams. Feminist in residence. Feminism has always been important to me. My parents raised all three of us with this, these ideas at the forefront of life for anybody, no matter what you are, who you are, what you do. And it had always been important in my work. To me, feminism is about, pushing back against the expected male gaze, pushing back against patriarchy, which is the system that, you know, pretty much, you know, our entire civilization is founded on it. Mm-hmm. The system it engages in. And I always viewed everything through a critical feminist lens, and sometimes that annoyed boyfriends. I'm married to a feminist, which is great. I'm going to slow down here and digress a little bit. But when I was in grad school, I did an independent study project where I interviewed women in the arts about identifying as a woman artist and how they felt about that, and if that was important to them or if they preferred not to. I interviewed Wendy Olsoff of PPOW Gallery, which has always been one of my favorite galleries, very feminist, extremely diverse roster of artists, and they really take a lot of risks and have shown people who whose work, you know, didn't maybe fit into the mainstream. So incredible. A couple of women, if you don't know their gallery, look them up. But and I interviewed some college students at Parsons, where I was in grad school at the time. And all of them said, we don't need feminism. That's not important for me to identify that way. Like
at Parsons?
Yeah, this was 2010, 2009, 2010. They were all like, it's cool, it's good. And I mean, I went to a performance class taught by Martha Wilson, who's one of the most important performance artists in history, American history. And these students were making work about the female gaze versus the male gaze and all these things, but they didn't understand the connection to feminism. It was very strange. And at the time, I think you could see this in popular culture, that young women, young meaning, you know, early 20s or late teens, very much pushed against the idea of feminism and the need for it. And thank God that is over.
Yes.
Feminism is so cool now. It's back, and it's very exciting.
Yes, I love that. Thank you for sharing. Okay, Anna, I want to know, what is a goal that you have for the next 6 months?
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Let's do an art goal and a maternal goal.
Oh, okay. That's helpful, because survive would just be.
Yes.
Okay, 6 months art goal. I want to get through all the new work that I've shot recently, get it all. It's quite a process on the post-production when shooting medium format film. So it's a lot of steps, and I want to get through all of that and get it up online and finished. Mm-hmm. and organized and like presented. And would like to do something with it, show it somewhere. Yeah, I like to show old work too. I still show pictures from sophomore year of college. It's all part of this pictures series. And I like to show the whole, like a long chronology of things. So I'd love to show a selection of new and old work. And not to show it in the next 6 months, but get something secured in that time would be great. And a maternal goal would be to try to not yell at my kids so much.
I need some of that goal too.
We have a lot of hours in the day that you've always been teaching your children and caring for them full time. So you're a veteran.
A little bit.
But for me, this is new to have all these hours in the day in which I have to talk to them.
Yes. The homeschooling and the caretaking and the job on Zoom. And yeah, it's a lot. Yeah. It's a lot. Okay. And I can't let you go without asking you to share just a little bit of advice for other artists. Cause this is your career. I mean, you provide career counseling for artists. So could you just share, you know, a tidbit of your wisdom or two, something practical for artists?
Okay. There's a lot of pressure in that.
Something easy.
Yeah. Define success for yourself. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to do that. It's really hard to ignore the accomplishments of those around you in terms of the feeling of envy. Jerry Saltz always says, one of the rules for artists, how to be an artist, make an enemy of envy. And it's critical. It's critical to your sanity to do that. It's not like you accomplish that and then it's good. You're good. No, it's a constant battle with envy, I think. And so our own idea of success is so wrapped up in what others are doing and what we perceive to be the expectation of success. And if you can do some soul searching for yourself and figure out what's important to you and your practice and where you want it to go, where you see it, where you see your work living, then you'll be a lot more satisfied. I'm still working on that myself.
So. That was beautiful. I think that is like something we always have to be doing probably, right? Like rewriting our definition of success sort of as our careers and our lives change.
Absolutely. It's a moving target.
Yes.
So as we age or our lives change, that changes. As the world around us changes and the opportunities that are available shift. Absolutely.
Okay. Final five. You ready?
Oh God. Okay. This is lightning round. I have to go. I'm not going to.
It doesn't have to be like first thought, but you know, you can take your time. It doesn't have to be one answer, but you know, just it's meant to be like sort of a quick few final questions.
Okay.
Okay. So who is your biggest art crush?
I got to say two.
Okay.
Sally Mann, the photographer.
Yep.
The quintessential photographing her nude children.
Yes.
Who has been subjected to so much harassment. And Ann Patchett, the novelist. Mm.
Love, love, love. Have you read Hold Still?
Ah, amazing.
Yes,
incredible.
So good.
So moving.
Okay, Anna, what is your favorite place to travel or what is a dream trip you'd like to go on?
I've always wanted to go to Spain. I haven't been a lot of places in the world, but I've been to a few, but Spain is at the top of my list when the world changes.
Okay. So tell me, what is a film or a book that has inspired you greatly?
Okay, so the film was shown to me in my first semester in art school, where I felt like this Midwesterner fish out of water, and everything was exciting. It's a short film by the photographer Robert Frank, who is most famous for his documentary project, The Americans, a really important body of work about American life in the 50s. And this short film it's a weird little movie. It's about the Beat Generation, and Jack Kerouac narrates, and he, you know, improvises and ad-libs the whole narration, but he tells the story of this family, this husband and wife and their son living in New York, in the East Village in the 50s, and it's dark. You can hardly see even what's happening. The music is created by a really important jazz musician, David Amram, and Allen Ginsberg is in it. Gregor Corso, Larry Rivers, the painter, plays the father in the film, and they're all friends. They were all these guys were just friends, and you know, men were kind of shit in the Beat Generation, and it's clearly that's what's happening in this film. And it just, for me, it's just a moment in American history that's beautifully depicted. You can see it on YouTube. I recommend just watch it's like, I don't know, half an hour or something.
What was the name again?
Pull My Daisy.
Pull My Daisy by Robert Frank.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll have to look that up. And I know you want to share a book because you're like a diehard Ann Patchett fan. Ah! Right?
Yes. Yes. My favorite, The Dutch House is her most recent book, and that might be my favorite, but I think Commonwealth.
Oh, I love Commonwealth. I think it's the only, I've only read two Ann Patchett.
But what was the other one that you read?
The other one was the one about the jungle, like the
State of Wonder.
Yes, that was a great book too, but I loved Commonwealth.
Yeah.
Commonwealth felt a lot like your photos feel. Like it had this like Americana, nostalgic, painful, like, I don't know.
Caitlin, I love you.
Oh, no, I totally didn't say that just to make you happy, but no, really, like just thinking about it, you know, it's just like, it just had this feeling like it didn't feel good or, I don't know, like light, but it was still beautiful. And I think your photos are like that.
Thank you. I mean, yeah. I think that's why, not to say that my pictures are like Ann Patchett's incredible writing, but that I think that's why I love that story so much, because it feels like what I like to do and what is interesting to me, which is just real painful stories that might not be so incredible, but just kind of what we all are experiencing. And that book is really special because it's the book about her own childhood and family.
Oh, I didn't know that.
She has, and you can watch interviews where she talks about this, but she writes, all of her novels are these incredible stories where she's done tons of research. She's going to Brazil, living in the Amazon, so she can write a book about it. She's an incredible researcher, extremely thorough. And she, for years, was writing stories about all these people that were so far removed from all these worlds and lives that were so far removed from her, in order to not write about her own story, because she didn't feel like she could, because it would upset her family. And she finally did write the story about her own life and childhood and family, but she realized that her whole life she'd been telling the story of her family through another lens, but it was always two communities of, or more of than two, communities of people coming together who didn't know each other and had to form a new community together, which is what she had to do with her blended family as a kid that formed in a pretty painful way.
Right.
That was incredible to me.
Yeah, that's so, so beautiful. And you are definitely an Ann Patchett nerd.
I am. I'm sorry.
You're like, you know, on the interviews with her, I'm like, how many people read interviews with their favorite author? Oh, I love it. Okay, what is your favorite meal?
Oh, God, pizza.
Yes.
Oh, man, I love pizza.
Are you a New York pizza person?
Well, I like all pizza, except the Chicago deep dish is, I can't handle it. It's not really pizza.
It's like a casserole, kind of.
Thank you.
You know?
Yes. Yeah.
If you have to eat it with a fork and a knife, it's not pizza.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can only have one piece. And then you're done with pizza, in quotes, for the next, I don't know, month. It's too much.
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, Instagram knows me because I always get ads for pizza.
That's funny.
Maybe that's a bad sign.
Oh, there's nothing like New York pizza, though, man.
I
miss it so much. I like the pizza where you can fold it and you can eat like three or four pieces and you can still, you know, have dessert. Like,
yes. If I could tell a couple stories about this, when I recently got to social distance with your sweet parents.
Oh, yes.
Who are, and you are from Western New York.
Yes, near Buffalo. Yes. So there's lots of Italian immigrants. Like, we know good pizza, even though we're 5 hours from the city.
Right. They said the New York pizza folks come out to Western New York and open a restaurant.
They're Yep.
This pizza everywhere, that's not real pizza. New York is the pizza. So I was really surprised and delighted.
I love that they've already defended our pizza background to you. That's so great. I love it.
And the comedian Colin Quinn has a great bit about New Yorkers, how you fold, you have to fold your food and eat it and walk.
Yes.
It's been very hard for me to escape the idea of not having to walk while eating. Like, I'm allowed to just sit down. Like, what are you talking about? We gotta.
Yes, I love that. Well, you'll have to figure out what's the best pizza in LA soon.
I don't even. Oh, God.
It'll be like quinoa crust and avocado with Himalayan sea salt.
Cashew cheese.
Yeah.
You know, after Chicago casserole pizza, I'm ready for that.
Like, yeah. Yay.
For the quinoa pizza.
I love it. Okay, Anna, last question. I just like to offer you the space to give a shout out to an artist or, you know, anybody really who supported you and your work.
That's such a hard
thing. You can share a few if you want.
There's so many. There's just so many people who have made me into the person that I am and continue to help me be a good person. And see my art through. And I mean, my husband, of course, is always a big support, my biggest supporter. But I have to say my mom, because even though she hates having her picture taken and as a woman and who is aging, I think it's particularly difficult. And the world doesn't let women age. She still opens up for me and, helps me to make some of, I think, the most powerful pictures that I've been able to make.
I can't wait to see, you know, what pictures you continue to take of her in the future too.
Thank you.
Okay, friend, where can people find you? What's your Instagram and website?
Yeah. Instagram is at Anna Ogier, A-N-N-A-O-G-I-E-R. And the website is Anna Ogier Bloomer, all one word. Should I spell it?
We'll link to it.
Out of a lot. Thank you.
Yeah.
No one has to remember how to spell my last name.
Just Google. You'll find her. Oh, thank you so much. This was so delightful. You are such a peach and I love you. And, I'm just so thankful for your friendship and, you know, all the ways that you support artists. It means a lot to me and I know to so many. So thanks for sharing a bit about your story instead of just focusing on everybody else. It was really good to hear more about Anna. Thanks, friend.
Thank you so much for making the space for this. It's not something I do very often and don't usually feel very comfortable, so I appreciate you.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast. Thank you.